Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Proverbs, verse by verse. Proverbs 17:5 is where we pick up today. Solomon writes, "He who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished." Here's a severe warning against twin evils, the nexus of which is callousness toward those in pain. One of those evils is mocking the poor, either in the form of making light of the burden of poverty. One can do that either by trivializing the plight of the poor or disparaging them for their condition. The other twin is gloating over the misfortune of others. That represents the very spirit of hate which underlies the act of murder. Wishing others were dead or crushed is, in the spirit of the law of God, no different from the physical act of murder. Embedded in the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," is an implicit prohibition against such a spirit. This is serious business. He who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. For in the providence of God, he is so. And he who rejoices at calamity, God will not allow to go unpunished. I remember a college girl in Spokane. Her mother won $700 playing bingo and gave something like $100 or $200 of the proceeds to some family in need whom she knew. Her daughter protested vehemently about the waste, kind of reminds you of Judas, complaining of the waste when Mary poured out the valuable perfume on our Lord's feet, saying this money could have been given to the poor. Well, this girl protested vehemently about the waste. She complained that the money could have been spent on her. Her mother, flabbergasted at her daughter's callous attitude, explained that these folk were in straits and had real need of extra cash. "Oh, Mom, everybody has a hard luck story," she mocked. The mother, who was relating this to our daughter, said, "Christy, where have I gone wrong? Such selfishness begs for divine retribution. Someday that daughter may be visited with poverty and be slimed with the same sliming contempt and mockery. These things have a way of coming back on us." In verse 6 of chapter 17, we are told that grandchildren are the crown of old men and the glory of sons is their fathers. In a normal society, a healthy society where family is cherished, to live to see one's grandchildren is a great blessing. On the other end, for their children, parents are a proud heritage. That is, in a good, solid family, children will look with pride upon their elders, while in turn their elders take great pride in all extended progeny. Where this mutual pride is lacking, it is a sign of either a dysfunctional family or a sick society or both. And we're seeing a lot of it in our degenerating culture. We have all kinds of bias today, but one is ageism or generational bigotry. Solomon says in 17:7, "Excellent speech is not fitting for a fool, much less are lying lips to a prince." Certain proverbs talk about things that are jarringly unseemly, things that entail inherent contradictions, and speak of people miscast in their roles. For example, A fool of all people has absolutely no excuse to brag about Flip. So it is jarring, not to mention annoying, for a fool to assume any air of superiority to anyone. As offensive as is an arrogant fool, there is one mismatch worse yet, Solomon says. A lying ruler, a servant of justice, that is one who perverts the very justice he is entrusted to serve. Such a proverb is intended to deflect us from such a course by shame. These proverbs, remember, they are intended to be a compass for the wise. They are intended to be a mirror for the wise, to help us take stock of ourselves. In verse 8, chapter 17, the sage says a bribe is a charm in the sight of its owner. Wherever he turns, he prospers. Now, this proverb is not expressing a moral value, but like certain other adages, it is merely a dose of reality, what we call reality therapy, for those entering into the rough and tumble of life. And it echoes the old saying, money talks. One reason bribes are illegal in the marketplace is because money does talk and beggars walk. Bribes may not be right, but they are often effective in gaining their ends, unjust as they may be. I had an uncle long since passed who was a lumberman back in my native state of West Virginia, and he used to regularly pay kickbacks to one of our former governors before he became a governor. That governor later went to prison for just that kind of activity. Verse 8 is not a good commentary on human nature, but it is a realistic assessment, and anyone unaware of this fact is naive in the extreme about the way a lot of people, a lot of crooked people, get things done in this world. So this adage is an important reminder to the wise about expectations in life. You see, folks, let's never forget this. Life is not fair. It is not a level playing field, and don't expect it to be until the Lord returns. You may have the best design, but the other guy may have the most money. You may bring the most to the table, but someone else offers more under the table. Don't go shoot yourself. This is just the way it is a lot of times. And as long as this present sinful world turns on its axis, this is the way it is going to be, realistically, all of our laws against it notwithstanding. The wise man has to get real about the way life actually works. In 17:9, Solomon says, "He who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends." What Solomon is saying, in my words, is this: sealed lips save friendships. Loose lips sink ships. Friendships can be as fragile as they are precious. You see, folks, here's something we need to understand. The closer people are, the greater their expectations of their friends. One thing we never expect of a friend is a stab in the back or a painful backlash from an indiscreet tongue. If no one else, one ought always to be able to feel safe from the mouth of his friends. When we cause our friends pain by talking about them behind their back or repeating things, we can drive a wedge between them and their friends, not to mention ourselves. To be discreet and respect the secrets and the privacy of our trusting friends waters loving relationships. To blabber everything we know spells the death of relationships. No friendship can long survive a tongue that tells all. Never forget that if you have a tendency to have a loose tongue. If you wonder where your friends have gone, there might be the answer. Proverbs 17:10 says, "A rebuke goes deeper into one who has understanding than 100 blows into a fool." Unlike a fool who is thick-headed and virtually impermeable to any amount of correction, one of the many noble marks of a wise person is that when he errs, it takes only a simple reproof, and he gets it. He doesn't keep making excuses. He doesn't keep passing the buck, and he doesn't constantly go into denial. Rather, he takes responsibility for his errors, and he makes every effort not to repeat them. You see, the wise get it. The fool kicks it. 17:11, the great King Solomon says, "A rebellious man seeks only evil, so a cruel messenger will be sent against him." What does he say? There is a kind of person, we've all met them, men or women, a kind of person who lives in a state of reaction and rebellion. They tend to be unhappy. They tend to be angry. So many activist types fit into this mode. They just want somebody to strike out against. They're by disposition always against whatever those in charge dispose or propose. You've seen them in your workplaces. You've seen them in your union halls. You've seen them in civic life. You've seen them in the streets and in the town halls. You've seen them in the media and every place they can make their voice heard. And you've seen them in the churches. They seem to be born in a state of rebellion. And some of them are quite proud of the fact. I once heard this roller derby promo where this lady says, "I have no problem with authority. I just have a problem with people telling me what to do." People in this mode tend to make life hard on themselves, for sooner or later, people tire of their antics and squeaky wheel mode, and in the end, people tend to come down on them pretty hard when their patience runs out. Kidner says aptly, "Since rebellion scorns moderation, the rebel need expect none." Pitiless rebellion, sooner or later, meets with pitiless retribution, a kind of poetic justice. And the retribution may come in impersonal as well as personal forms, as ultimately it comes from God. God loathes a rebellious spirit. And that rebellious spirit that American individualism is so fond of admiring is an ugly residual of the rebellious foundations of our nation. Rebellion is in our national bloodstream. So to the wind you reap the whirlwind. We seldom think about that with reference to our national history. Proverbs 17, verse 12. "Let a man meet a bear robbed of her cubs rather than a fool in his folly." We all know few things are more dangerous than tangling with a mama bear with her cubs nearby. But that encounter, Solomon tells us, is safer than meeting a fool in his folly, because fools know no restraint. They think they are bulletproof. They act like they're above the law, and they do the dumbest things imaginable. They're like a toddler with a loaded gun, most likely to shoot themselves and whoever is in range. If you know a fool is a fool, and you can easily figure that out by immersing yourself in the book of Proverbs, if you know a fool is a fool, the best thing you and I can do is give the fool an even wider berth than a bear with her cubs. What you know for sure is that a fool is a fool and will do, according to his nature, foolish things. So be smart and leave him to his own kind. The trouble with us is that sometimes we operate on this notion that the fool will not act a fool with us, but that is a dangerous and very misguided assumption. 17:13 says, "He who returns evil for good, evil will not depart from his house." Whoa. It is one thing to pay back evil for evil. That is wrong. For the Lord tells us, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay. You keep out of it." But when one is so perverse that he pays back evil for good, that brings a curse from the Lord. That is what David did to Uriah, one of his finest and most loyal soldiers. When first he impregnated Bathsheba, Uriah's wife, and then to cover it up, had Joab, his field general, expose Uriah to a battle situation where Uriah was likely to be killed, as did happen. David was very repentant. He was forgiven. But let us not forget that it set in motion a chain, a seriatim of evils that illustrates this warning. Evil shall never depart from his house, and it never did. Folks, we got our ears on. Let's be very careful here. I cannot understand how people get themselves so morally and ethically twisted that they can return evil for good. But I'll tell you something. In my pastoral experience, I have experienced this perversity many times. I've told you many times of my dad's famous to me words, "Bud, don't ever mess with God." When people have done you nothing but good, be very afraid. I say again, be very afraid. If you for some reason turn on them and do them evil, talk about the Furies coming to visit you over and over again. If you have done that and know you've done that, my advice to you is repent as fast as you can and as fully as possible. Go first to the one to whom you've done it, and then go to the Lord and plead for his forgiveness. You will get it if you're honest, but don't let that lie. Verse 14, the beginning of strife, Solomon says, is like letting out water. So abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. Here is very sage advice for those who are quick, too quick to draw verbal swords. The image here is graphic. It's so realistic. Starting a quarrel is like breaching a dam. We know it is next to impossible to arrest the water once it has started over the spillway. The smartest thing to do is to drop the matter, if possible, before it becomes a contention. You see, contentiousness rarely accomplishes anything constructive because pride and ego get all bound up in the issues and cloud them, and it's then that things get out of hand. In such disputes, combatants contend for pride rather than resolution, and truth becomes a side issue. The opposite parties fling around words just trying to save face and not be bested in the contention. It's all a matter of scoring points, and solving the problem gets lost in the desire to show up one's opponent. Honest, candid dialogue, friends, is valuable. But bickering, the kind that one often hears on TV talk shows, radio talk shows, is less enlightening than entertaining, and almost never moves the matter forward. Sometimes contentious issues must be dealt with, and there is no way sometimes to avoid sharp words. But one should try as hard as possible to keep the heat down, to stick to the issues, and avoid making personalities the issue, which so often happens in these verbal wrangles. The beginning of strife, let us all understand, is like letting out water. The smart, the prudent, the wise thing to do, abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. Seek peace with all men, Paul said, as much as lieth in you. You go as far as you can to try to maintain the peace, because nothing good is going to come of strife. That's different from honest dialogue, different from honest debate, but bickering strife, where we're just ripping and tearing at one another, we've all done it, I suppose. I've never seen any good come of it, whether I was involved in it or someone else. Never seen anything good come of that from the strife itself. Chapter 17, verse 15, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. Here's a little dose of theological reality. You do not want to be a target of the Lord's indignation. Solomon says, let anyone entrusted with the duty of enforcing justice be apprised of the seriousness of his obligation. to be fair and impartial in judgment. You do not have to be an appointed or elected judge or magistrate for this to apply. You can be a boss on the job, wherever it is, in any venue. You have to be fair and equitable. Well, this proverb says, he who justifies the wicked for whatever motive, maybe they're your blood relative, maybe they're your friend, he who condemns the righteous because you don't like them for some reason, well, God says both of them are an abomination in my sight. That's not a tag anybody wants. Our obligation is to be fair and impartial in judgment. God is no respecter of persons, nor should we be, whether they're our children or whoever. Our obligation is to refuse bribes and respect the rights of victims, for whether or not we know it, when we're in that position, we are a surrogate minister of God, and God himself detests, abhors, acquitting the guilty and condemning the innocent. There's a price to pay for that. The implicit warning is, if we don't heed this admonition somewhere down the road, God himself will drop the hammer on those who pervert justice. A perverse human being may be too high and mighty for the victims of his unjust treatment to hold accountable. But I'll tell you this, God knows, and God has no such problem. And in his time, he will land on those who pervert justice, and he will land hard. Verse 16, why is there a price in the hand of a fool to buy wisdom when he has no sense? This is an unusual proverb in that it comes in the form of a question. The idea, according to McCain, and I suspect he is right, pictures a fool who wants a reputation of a sage. So he brings his tuition money to one of that renown. Being a fool, however, makes his money irrelevant. Why? Because he is by nature unteachable, but has the vain notion that money can buy even wisdom, exemplifying his native foolishness. You know, it's like a fool going to an elite college. He can't learn anything that is tantamount to wisdom and understanding. $100,000 a year at Harvard won't help such people. All the money in the world could not make a fool wise. As I say, he could attend the best universities, acquire the most advanced degrees, but because he is natively a fool, at the end of the day, the ignorant fool would be no more than a learned fool, because he neither recognizes true wisdom, nor does he have any appetite for it. Verse 17 of chapter 17. A friend loves at all times, but a brother is born for adversity. Like wealth, friends can be fickle. You know, we never really know who our real friends are until times of trouble. Those times when we have nothing to give back, and they have nothing to gain, but perhaps even a lot to lose by standing by us and supporting us. That's when we find out who our friends are. When adversity strikes us, fair-weather friends have nothing for us but words, if that. Some just disappear until the storm is over. But true friends, real friends, like brothers, are there for the hard times as well as the good times. The lesson here is this. When you're trying to sort out the pecking order in your social relationships, well, just see who sticks with you when they have nothing to gain and you have nothing to give. One can normally count on family to do that, and after family, only true friends will be there. Well, friends, our time has expired for today. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and tune in again next time.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com, and our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.